That's it. Thank you. When I was in sixth form, which was a little while ago now, I was, I think I was 17, about that age, and there was a girl who I liked. And, you know, I thought she was wonderful. We had a lot in common. She was a Christian. She played the cello. I played the cello. You know, it felt like it was made to be, of course. And it seemed like we were, you know, getting quite close. It seemed like something might happen. And then it was a little bit before Christmas time where it all went wrong. There's a couple of sympathetic people out there. And she... to my pain, she got together with someone else, someone who happened to be one of my friends. I know, right? Who knew that I liked her? We'd had conversations about this. I might have forgiven him, I'm not quite sure. And of course, being the level-headed teenager that I was, my life was over. And I dealt with it very badly. and I can remember being... we had a Christmas ball, school Christmas ball thing. And I can remember being there at the end of it. And one of the last songs that was played was "All I Want for Christmas Is You." And I can remember that. And I can remember distinctly being sat in the back. It was my friend had passed his driving test and he was driving us away at the end. I can just remember being sat in the back of this car, just being sad and lonely. Thank you. There we go. Anyway, I almost appreciate your mock pity. And, you know, I was, you know, of course, I was 17. And so I did manage to get over it in a longer period of time than I should have done, but of course moved on. But as we come, we think about Christmas and we think about loneliness. Of course, there are things that are a lot more serious than my 17-year-old self. We come, we think about Christmas, and we know that there will be people who are feeling distinctly lonely this Christmas, maybe because they've lost someone who won't be there this Christmas time. Maybe because they just don't have the family around them and the relationships that they wish that they had with others. So often as we come and we talk about loneliness, often we think about those who are older, and I've definitely shared statistics before about loneliness amongst those who are older, and we get reminded of those statistics sometimes, don't we, by charities saying, well, there's how many old people go a week without really talking to anybody or seeing anybody. But actually, I was surprised by these statistics, that a quarter of people who are aged 25 to 34... asked in a survey, said that they would feel lonely at Christmas, that they expected to feel lonely at Christmas. And that 10% of millennials, this will surprise me too, millennials, those who were born somewhere around the mid-1980s to about the turning of the millennium, that 10% of those people actually spend Christmas on their own. Actually, as we come and talk about loneliness, this isn't just something that affects just a few people, but actually, whether we ourselves will feel lonely at Christmas or not, we will almost certainly know someone who will be feeling lonely this Christmas. They may even be surrounded by people and yet feel lonely. We've been doing a little series, and it's been based on this book, Rescuing Christmas. And the beginning of this morning is thinking about how we rescue Christmas from loneliness. We're looking for a joy in Christmas that lasts, that is something that isn't just about either getting through Christmas or getting to Christmas and enjoying it briefly and then it all goes away afterwards. But looking at these wise men, we read in verse 10, when they saw the star, they were overjoyed. They found some kind of joy in what was happening. Can we grasp something of what they had for ourselves this Christmas? There are still some copies of this book in the foyer, so if you'd like to have one and read in a little bit more to what we've been talking about, if you've missed the other 2 weeks that we've done leading up to this week, the books are there, or if you want to take them to give away to others, they are there for you to use and to have, and they're free. As we've been talking about, we've been reminded that some of our assumptions, perhaps, about the wise men are incorrect. We get the first line of the carol, "We three kings of Orient are the three." The kings and the Orient are almost certainly wrong. But the rewording it to "we indeterminate number of learned ones from somewhere a fair way to the east of Judea" doesn't sound like it would sing so well. And both Matt and I have already pointed that out. But also Matt picked up last week, and I'll pick up this week, that when we come to some of the gifts, actually, the carol does quite well. Actually, when it comes to thinking about what these gifts were about, we've been thinking, we're on the third week, so we're thinking about the gifts that the kings gave, gold and frankincense and myrrh. Because we're on week three, we're naturally thinking about frankincense, because that's the way I made it work. And in the carol, as we've already been told, frankincense to offer have I, incense owns a deity nigh. That actually, when it talks about frankincense and these wise men bringing frankincense, it was an incense. As Christine's already been helping us understand and even giving us a little sniff of, it was this incense. It was something that was burned in the temple, burned in worship to God. And in some churches, it is still done today. Like that image up there, some churches, if you went into some of their services, some of their worship, someone would be swinging something around and smoke would be coming out of it. And it is deliberate. And they're still burning incense today as a sign of their worship and as a sign of God's presence with them. Now, if we want to understand this a little bit, you're going to have to just take a little bit of a journey back into the Old Testament, where actually this all begins, where God's people are instructed to worship in this way. So bear with me a moment while we do that for a few minutes, because it helps us understand what it is that's going on with the wise men, and they come and offer this gift. So we read about this back in Exodus chapter 30, when they're given instructions for the building of the temple. Way back in Exodus, the second book of the Bible. It says this: put the altar in front of the curtain that shields the Ark of the Covenant law. So right at the centre of the temple was the Ark of the Covenant, which had the tablets of stone with the Ten Commandments on and a bunch of other stuff in. And this was where God would dwell, sometimes called the Holy of Holies. So there's this curtain that shields it off from the rest of it, the Holy of Holies. This is where God's presence would be. This is where God would dwell. And then there's a curtain in front of that, a curtain shielding off that Ark. And in front of that, he's being told to put this altar where he would burn incense. And this cloud would come out from burning this incense in the temple. What does the royal standard flying on top of Windsor Castle mean? Good. You all live locally enough to realise this is the case. Yeah, the Queen is home. Fun fact I discovered recently. I've been suspicious about this from seeing the castle from a distance sometimes. They do have different sizes of royal standard. Didn't know that. I learned that recently. Some of them are really big. And so on the special occasions, if it's not too windy, they'll get out the really big ones. Didn't know that. Learned that recently. Thought that was quite fun. But anyway, it's a sign. You learn something new every day. It's a sign that the Queen is there, isn't it? It's a sign that they're there. And that's a point of burning this incense. That this cloud of smoke was to be a sign, a symbol, if you like, that God is here. A sign, a symbol of God's presence being in that place. And the next few verses in Exodus 30 say what they're meant to do with it. Aaron must burn fragrant incense on the altar every morning when he tends the lamps. There were some lamps in there that would be burning all the time. He must burn incense again when he lights the lamps at twilight, so the incense will burn regularly before the Lord for the generations to come. So all the way back in Exodus, right in the beginning of the Bible, as they're setting up the temple, this place to worship God, they're being told, right at the place, right where I'm going to be dwelling, where I'm going to be living at the heart of you, you're to burn this incense regularly, morning and evening. You're to make this cloud of smoke, this symbol of my presence, that I am there and that I am amongst you. This is the place where you're to come and worship as a sign that I am there. And the temple was then in Jerusalem. So the temple was built there in Jerusalem. And if you were to go and say, well, where do you want to go to get near to the presence of God? Where does God live? At the time of the Magi, at the time of the wise men, you would say, well, you go to the temple in Jerusalem. This is the place where God's presence is. In fact, there's only one little wall now left of that temple, which gets called the Wailing Wall, because people still go there today to try and get a sense of being near God and bringing their prayers to God, because there's only one bit of it left. So for Jews today, that's still massively important, because you want to go and get near that place where God dwelled in the temple And if you want to bring your prayers to him, well, you can't get closer to God than going to that one wall of it that's left in Jerusalem to try and get near to God. And this is the point about why we've taken this little journey backwards. Because after Jesus was born, the Magi from the east turn up in Jerusalem. They say that they've come, they're looking for the king of the Jews. So naturally they go to the capital, they turn up to Jerusalem to say, well, where's the one who's been born king of the Jews? Because this is the kind of place that we would expect him to be born. And they turn up in Jerusalem where the temple is. And then they get told, well, he's going to be born in Bethlehem. That's what the scriptures say. He's going to be born in Bethlehem. So off they go. And the thing is, they come to this place where the temple is, where the presence of God is, where incense, where frankincense is being offered morning and evening in worship to God as a sign of his presence. And they leave with their frankincense. They don't go and offer it in the place where you offer it. They don't go and take it to the temple, to the place where God is, to the place where you can get the nearest to God, where the priests morning and evening are offering and burning this incense. They take it with them. They walk off with it. And they take it, and they bring it, and they offer it, not in the temple, not near the Holy of Holies, but they offer it to Jesus. And they give it to him. They take this thing, which is a sign of God's presence being there, and they give it to Jesus. And they point us to what Jesus was fulfilling, the scriptures that we may well know from Isaiah in the Old Testament, hundreds of years before Jesus was born. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel. Emmanuel means God with us. They're pointing us towards saying that God, you may dwell in the temple, but now God has come and dwelled in this child. In this young child, we've offered our incense in worship, not in the temple, but here to this boy. Here is God that we have come to worship. And we read that's what they do. They come and they worship him and they offer him their gifts. They're pointing us to the fact that God in Jesus has come close. That God has come and walked amongst us. And what he's offering us in Jesus Christ is the gift of friendship. We looked the first week at gold and said, actually, this is the gift of leadership. That Jesus is the one who could rightfully rule over the whole world, is the one who's come to be king of the whole world, and that offers us the gift of leadership to be, if you like, king of our lives. Matt helped us last week as we thought about myrrh, that Jesus came to offer us a clean start, the gift of a clean start. Myrrh points us to his death, and that through Jesus' death, we can have a clean start with him. The gold shows us who Jesus is. The myrrh shows us what Jesus has come to do. And the frankincense shows us what we have through that. That we can be friends with God. That we can be friends with him. That in response to the loneliness that we might feel and the loneliness that there might be, we're offered friendship with God himself. But maybe we don't feel that that's particularly good news. Maybe for whatever reason we feel, well, I've got enough friends, thank you very much, and being friends with God sounds like it might be quite a lot of work, so he might be quite demanding in some way, and I'm not sure that I really want that. And is he really there anyway? And I think actually sometimes as we come and we think about our loneliness, it points us to a deeper truth, a deeper thing that actually maybe is a struggle that's more universal. A long time ago, a guy called Augustine said this, our hearts are restless. Our hearts are restless. And he was pointing to something that maybe a lot of us feel, a sense of restlessness and struggle. Someone said this, the only thing worse than not achieving your dreams is achieving them. The only thing worse than not achieving your dreams is achieving them. And from the book that we're looking at, it picks out a number of significant and famous people who you'd think in different ways had achieved their dreams and got everything and are living the life, and yet revealed to us in different ways how they haven't. He points out this. A guy called Jack Higgins, who's a famous author. This was his book that made him, I think it sold something like over 50 million copies, if you're not into literature, like me. And he was asked, what do you wish you'd known at 16 that you know now you're 60? And he said this, I wish I'd known that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. Or for a slightly more contemporary reference, this is Ed Sheeran, this is the lyrics from one of his songs. I think it's Eraser. I chase the picture-perfect life. I think they painted it wrong. Ain't nobody want to see you down in the dumps because you're living your dream, man. This should be fun. You've got everything. You've become famous. You've achieved all your dreams, all your ambitions. You've become this superstar in the music world. You should be living the dream. No one wants to see that really you're unhappy because you look like you've got everything. Or I like this one, somewhere in the middle, Bob Geldof, who's the guy behind Live Aid and Band Aid and things that some people here will remember. And that song that gets repeated a lot at this time of year. And he was asked the question, do you feel fulfilled? And this was his answer. Not at all. I don't think I know what that would mean. I'm unfulfilled. Otherwise, why are these large holes here? I'm frightened of it. It makes me very depressed. So I stay active, frenetically so, and that allows me to think I'm not wasting my time. There's deep sadness, isn't there? In people who you think have achieved so much, and yet have this restlessness and this emptiness. Our hearts are restless. Augustine said this. He was talking to God. He said, you have made us for yourself. And our hearts are restless until they can find rest in you. You have made us for yourself. And our hearts are restless until they can find rest in you. He's pointing us to God and saying that we would always have this restlessness, always have this feeling of a hole or a gap or chasing after the dream, and we would keep running with that until we can find rest in God. Even back in the 4th century, he caught hold of something of this, that when we've got ambitions and dreams and aims, that even when we grasp them, we find that we're just still grasping after something more. And what he points us to is that we're rescued from this restlessness for friendship with God, that our hearts can find rest in the knowledge of friendship with God and of walking with him. This is what he's offering us in Jesus Christ. And this is what Jesus said of himself when we come to John chapter 15, verse 15. He says this, I no longer call you servants. He's talking to his disciples. Because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. Jesus comes and the Magi offer in this gift of frankincense, this offering of worship that God has come to be present with us in the here and now. And Jesus himself walks later with his disciples as a grown man and says to them and says to us, I want to be friends with you. I want to walk with you. I want to do life with you. I want you to find rest in me. I want you to find freedom from your restlessness in me. I want to find freedom from the restlessness of loneliness in me. And he offers you a life that doesn't have to be in loneliness or in restlessness or in chasing after a dream. He offers a life to you that is set free from those things through having friendship and walking with him. And maybe that's something that you've never even really comprehended. Maybe you've even been in church for a little while, but not really grasped, but actually what God offers you, What, in fact, God wants from you is to be with you, is to have a relationship or friendship with you. That actually what we see in Jesus is not a God who's distant and far away, but one who's come to be near humanity, to be close to the people that he has made, to walk with us. We go back to the very beginning of the Bible in Genesis, we see Adam and Eve walking in the garden with God. And then it all goes wrong. And then God shows up again in Jesus to come and walk with us. And he offers you this friendship with him. Maybe you've been in church for a while. Maybe you've been a Christian for some time. Maybe you recognize that there were a time when you knew this kind of relationship with God, that you knew how he was there, that you had an understanding of his presence, that you knew involved daily in your life. But actually, if you're honest now, in whatever way it's happened, it's as though you've put him in a box. It's just a Sunday thing. That you don't walk with God in the same way anymore. That you don't have that kind of same friendship and relationship that there once was. And he's still there. What we're reminded of in Christmas is that he is still there. He is still God with us. His Spirit is still amongst us now, and you can still continue to know him today. Perhaps even something of what Wolf Geldof speaks of in having that kind of frenetic busyness just to cover up an emptiness. I think actually even sometimes we can manage that in the church. Actually sometimes even being involved in church life, we can manage a frenetic busyness because we're trying to cover up an emptiness. And actually what God asks of us is to walk with him, to be friends with him. Even someone, as they walked in this morning, they gave me a little picture of something of what this might look like, who came in and talked about that they were struggling with something incredibly difficult. And they said, so when I think about it, I just pray. What they were telling me was that they were someone who had a friendship with God. They say, when I face this thing, what do? I talk to my friend. I talk to the one who I know I can help me, who I know will listen to what I'm going through and what I'm struggling with. Someone else in my address this morning came and said, well, actually, could I talk to you later? Because there's this thing, and I'm not quite sure what to do about it. And I'd like to try and understand, if you like, what God thinks about this problem and this issue. Because I don't know what to do. And I hope they don't just want to talk to me. I hope actually what they're looking for is to know what God thinks. Because when we've got an issue and we're not quite sure what to do, we talk to our friends. Catch a glimpse in some of the people here who walk with God in something of this way and enjoy friendship with him. It's not just a sweet, fuzzy feeling. It's not just a bit of worship on a Sunday morning, but it's a relationship with him that endures. It's a relationship that endures through even times of hardship and difficulty and struggle, to know that he is there and that he continues to care and to love and to support and guide us, even when things are difficult, even when we're going through hardship, even when we feel a sense of loneliness. That actually we know that we are not alone because he is there. Perhaps God is saying to you this morning that actually all he wants for Christmas is you. That actually what he's after is friendship with you. And we see this pictured for us as we come and we think about Jesus' birth. As we come back and we look at this picture of Jesus coming, we so often think about Jesus being born as a saviour and the one who would come and who would die. And yes, that is entirely true. And we don't get Easter without Jesus' birth. And as Matt talked about last week, this is how we're rescued through. This is the way that Jesus has rescued us, is through his birth leading to his death on the cross. It's what the myrrh points us to. But let's not miss, as we think about Jesus coming, not just that he come to rescue us through his death, but what he's come to rescue us for. That he's come to rescue us for friendship with him. To walk and to live and to know him. That we're not just rescued through saying a prayer or assenting to a certain belief or saying what we think happened on the cross. But that what we're offered in Jesus is that he came to live and to walk with us. Not just 2,000 years ago, but today, to know friendship with him. And if you want to get a little picture or something of what that life without that restlessness looks like, I think a fantastic picture of us is in Jesus himself, who we talked about a few weeks ago, coming to be king of the whole world, the one who's rightfully ruler of everything, the one who's God himself come to be with us. And he isn't born in a temple, in a palace, into luxury and wealth, but is content to humble himself and be born where they kept animals and to lie in an animal feeding trough. There's a freedom from restlessness, set free to enjoy friendship with God. And this is good news. This is, if we know this, if we enjoy something of this, if we're able to walk in this life of knowing God, then actually we're able to show it in our lives. Let's not be afraid to show that actually, if you like, that we're content. We're content and we don't have that restlessness and that strife. And it's something that we can show and that we can share with others. That actually what we're looking for, what we're seeking to encourage, we're not just looking for people who are going to turn up at a church. We're not just looking for people who'll be converts. We're not wanting people who just give us their money. What are we looking for? What do we want to see more of in the world? I want to see people who are friends with God through what Jesus has done on the cross, are able to live in friendship and relationship with God. That's the good news that we can share at Christmas. That in Jesus, we see a God who's not distant and far off. Not someone who's off in the clouds. Not someone who's just sitting upon judgment on you. But one who stepped into the mess of this world to come and reach out to offer friendship with him. Know that we are people who are rescued from restlessness for a friendship with God. And that invitation is there for us all to walk each day in friendship with him. As we continue and as we worship together, take the opportunity to open yourself up to meet with him. Maybe you've never done that before. Maybe you have never really understood that God wants to know you and allow you to know him in that way. It's not something that you need to strive for, but it's something you can ask God to come and meet with you. And it begins a journey. It begins a journey, just like we see the wise men go on. We see them go on this ridiculous journey, having seen a star, to follow it, to leave their homes and travel, following this little glimpse of someone who had come. Invite God to come and begin that journey with him. And if you continue to pursue him, if you continue to seek to walk with him, to come to know him, then just like the Magi, one day you'll come and you'll meet God face to face. We can be rescued from restlessness for friendship with him, and one day meet him face to face. This is what the Magi give us a picture of journeying to find God and coming and meeting him in Jesus face to face. Let's pray.